Sheffield Live. Made in Sheffield, made by you.
If you like rock in all its forms, you will love Glory Days. You can listen to us locally on 93.2 FM and on the telly, and anywhere in the world on sheffieldlive.org. What do you think, Dawn? You know what, I think he likes it. That's Glory Days, every Monday 1 till 3 here on Sheffield Live. Bosh, bosh. Oops, I've had an accident.
Hello, I'm Harry Wilburn. I present Steel and Wire every Wednesday, 10 a.m. Americana, bluegrass, American roots, and more. Lots more. Lots of guests, lots of local music and musicians. That's Steel and Wire, Wednesday, 10 a.m.
You're listening to fabulous Harry Wilburn on Steel and Wire.
It's time to open the music box. Join me, Steve Roden, every Thursday morning between 10 and 12 for music from the 40s to the 90s from my own music collection. Songs I've grown up with, ones I am sure you will enjoy hearing again. Hope to see you then.
If you love new music and you want to discover the best new artists out there, then tune into The Backroom with me, Paddy. I'll be playing the best of new indie, electro, EDM and punk and showcasing new Sheffield talent. Also music news, local and national gig guide and new album releases. So tune into The Backroom every Thursday night between 6 and 7 p.m. here on Sheffield Live, 93.2 FM.
This is Sheffield Live.
N-E-X-T.
Good morning. Welcome to the Live Sounds Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM on digital if in South Yorkshire or sheffieldlive.org. You can listen online there, anywhere in the world apparently. You can also download the podcast later and listen at your leisure. This show is all about science in all its different forms. We talk about all sorts of stuff, guest speakers every week as well. You've got Julian Paul here live in the studio. Hello. As usual. We'll be talking to our PG later in this hour. I think he's doing something to do with humans, is he? And we've also got a guest speaker. If you tuned in last week, you would have heard Phil Muffett from the Rexburn Swinton Astronomical Society is back with us this week doing his Eye on the Sky. Club news, lots going off with public viewing events. Generally get sold out very quickly as well. Telling us more about that later. Next week, our guest speaker is Dr. Ogo Osamo. All being well, he's with us every second Saturday of the month. Loads to talk about. First up, a reminder, another guest speaker of ours, Gareth Morgan, who's member of and ex-president of the Sheffield Photographic Society. He's the third Saturday of the month, our speaker. A reminder that the Sheffield Photographic Society has got their open photography competition for 2026 live at the minute. The deadline is the 21st of February. You can email spsphotography514@gmail.com for more information, or just check out their social media pages. Also, a reminder about the smartphonefreechildhood.org website. You can sign the parent pact online there and join parents in your area who are delaying smartphones and social media. Hot topic moving forward. Let's see what the rest of the year brings. Elsewhere in the science news this week, Paul?
Right, the UK is to increase testing for so-called forever chemicals, or PFAS, in the environment as part of a national plan to tackle the substances. These chemicals are used in many everyday products because of their oil-resistant and waterproof properties, but they accumulate and remain in the environment with a small number of PFAS known to be toxic. The government says that by 2029 it wants to align more closely with regulations issued by the EU, which is looking to prohibit all non-essential uses. PFAS can be found in school uniforms, medication casings, cosmetics, baking equipment, frying pans and dishwasher rinse aid and polish. The number of water samples tested for PFAS will be increased by 50% across Scotland and Wales, whilst animals in coastal areas of England and soils in five priority areas will be tested to identify hotspots. As well as more testing, the government also wants to raise public awareness by launching a website dedicated to information on the chemicals. Meanwhile, the Royal Stoke University Hospital is set to become the UK's largest robotic surgery centre, following a £12 million investment from the Denise Coates Foundation, significantly expanding access to advanced robotic surgery across Stoke-on-Trent and Staffordshire. The move is expected to benefit more than 1,000 patients per year and assist with a range of complex procedures, including emergency and heart surgery. The hospital said it would also become the first in the UK to introduce new technology to enable surgeons to feel tissue resistance in real time. The advances would improve control, reduce unnecessary force, and support safer and more precise surgery, enable the Royal Stoke University Hospital to move forward closely to becoming a centre of excellence for robotics.
All very interesting. And on the subject of weather, another article by Paul Simons is called The Weather Eye. This article is from the end of December last year, but it's an interesting one about climate change, of course. The climate, the UK's climate is growing warmer. And the article says, at the risk of repeating a familiar story, the UK's climate is growing warmer. Fancy that. Just before Christmas, the Met Office announced that 2025 was on track to become one of the UK's warmest years on record in archives of temperature dating back to 1884. But then unusually warm years have become almost routine. The five warmest years in the UK have all happened in the past 25 years. And there's every indication that temperatures will carry on rising. In fact, by the middle of this century, we may look back at 2025 as simply an average year. Much the same pattern goes for abnormally high daily temperatures, given 30 degrees Celsius now occurs more frequently, as we saw last summer's four heat waves. And if there was any doubt about Britain's changing climate, it is revealing that the five coldest years all happened long, long ago in 1892, 1888, 1885, 1963 and 1919. So the UK's rising temperatures also mirror rising global temperatures. The Met Office's 2026 global assessment predicted that it would be the fourth consecutive year with an average temperature above 1.4 degrees Celsius, more than the pre-1900 average, which highlights a vanishingly small headroom we have to stay below 1.5 degrees Celsius and avoid the most severe effects of climate change. So driving the recent years of rising temperatures is a relentless increase in levels of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere from about 280 parts per million PPM in pre-industrial times to more than 420 parts per million today. Last year, there was a record high of 42.7 parts per million, an increase year on year of 3.75 parts per million on the previous year, and the largest one-year jump on record. And this year, oh my word, is on track to set another record at more than 425 parts per million, the highest concentration of CO2 for 2 million years. Of course, that article's written last year, so they were talking about 2025. So we are in extraordinary times in terms of our climate, so said Mike Kendon of the Met Office, and this is surely going to happen again in a few years' time. This pattern of breaking records in this way as climate change plays out over the course of this century. All interesting stuff.
Bye.
What a nice track, eh? About the Weather from Magazine back in 1981. Cracking. We played that because we're talking about the UK's climate is growing warmer. Yes, the same old story, and it's not going away. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to the Live Sounds Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM on digital if you're in South Yorkshire or sheffieldlive.org. We should have our PG on the line. Good morning, PG. Oh, hang on. Where's he gone? Are you there?
Hello?
Oh, I can hear you now. I think I haven't plugged you in properly, Paul. Don't tell
As
everybody.
Always.
Well, this is live radio. It can always go wrong, can't it?
Yeah.
But we've got you now, Paul. So what's caught your eye in the science news this week, then?
Oh, a couple of things. One was on the local front, Sheffield University again, and It kind of brought something out that I wondered about. Locally, some local shops, there was a food outlet appeared to be about to open quite a while, and we were sort of watching out for it, and every time, because it was close to shops that we go to, we were thinking, well, I wonder what's going to happen with that. It didn't seem to be. The front was all shuttered, and we thought, well, that's kind of weird. I don't know. And then as time went by, we went past and we said, well, there obviously smells of cooking coming from this place. And we thought, well, that's kind of funny because it's never open. So we thought, oh, that is weird. And then I saw this article from Sheffield University, and they said that they come up with a first agreed definition of dark kitchens.
Oh.
What they say is one in seven food outlets in the UK's major delivery apps is now a dark kitchen. And a dark kitchen is basically doesn't have an outward-facing presentation to the public other through delivery platforms. So they say that these dark kitchens now make up about 15% of the online food retailers operating on the delivery platforms.
Wow.
So the dark kitchens is set to address a major gap in understanding and coming up with regulation within this rapidly growing sector of the food industry. So these places aren't really sort of following the same protocols that other open aspects of the food delivery are. So basically, you don't know what's in it. you get the food delivered, but nobody's checking up on these sites.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, so I think the definition of dark kitchen is great. They're also known as cloud ghost or virtual kitchens, and they're just delivery only with no customer storefront. So I think that this is putting a handle to it that can actually drive people now to get regulation installed to make sure. Because increasingly, you know, we're a takeaway nation. I think they looked at a 2023 survey that found 40% of people who participated purchased a takeaway at least weekly and commonly via the delivery apps that are around. And only about 25% of participants had heard of dark kitchens, and about 10% knowingly purchased from one.
Ooh.
So, it's one of those things. I thought, well, how interesting. And so it kind of gave me a bit of an answer to the local conundrum that was there. But also I thought it's an interesting thing for us all to know about.
It isn't. To be fair, Paul, that's the first time I've heard that term.
Yes, I think it, and again, it's one of these things. I mean, we've had a couple of things from Sheffield University where they've coined a definition so that people can actually speak about things. Because, as I say, I wandered past this place, and it still doesn't open its storefront, but it is a delivery place, so you can order food from it. So I'm guessing that's the dark kitchen.
Very, very interesting. Mm.
Yeah, so that's interesting. The other thing was a bit crazy. I was sort of on my computer and sort of looking at the usual clickbait and rubbish that you see. And I saw this little article that said, the Russians are putting brain implants into pigeons that can convert them into drones. So I thought, well, hang on, I do know something that's kind of along those lines. Back in prior to the Second World War, a guy called Skinner was doing research on animal behaviour at Harvard University, and he came up with a behavioural box where they could train animals to get food rewards. They went to a red light or a green light. If they went to the red light, they got no food. Went to the green light, they got food. So they found that they worked with rats, but also with pigeons. And it became a famous experiment, Skinner's pigeons, because in the Second World War, they tried to develop it as a weapon. So when they were trying to track down a target, say a moving ship, they could launch a device, a bomb, that was controlled by a pigeon. And what it did is it could actually wreck the flight of this device by moving across to one of the ward lights that it had been conditioned to see. So if it was going off target, the pigeon would correct. So I thought, well, that's, yeah, okay, so what have the Russians done? Well, they've updated it, and they've taken a neural implant chip to put into a pigeon, and then they can strap a camera on a pigeon, and they can guide it in flight. So instead of having a drone that's buzzing and whirring and making some kind of noise that you can sort of get people to respond to, just a pigeon, of which I see hundreds of thousands around here, can fly over with a pigeon on and be spying on you.
Oh, no. People will be like looking at pigeons in a different way now, Paul.
Absolutely. So I thought, well, that really sort of opens up quite a lot. And I thought, well, if you go back to something like Doctor Who, you see in Doctor Who, then we got the Cybermen, who were supposedly controlled human beings, and we got an updated version of that, I think, in Star Trek, where there's a hive, a collection of people who are working with sort of a remote connection like a computer network. And sort of digging around, I thought, well, that's kind of interesting. And our old friend Elon Musk has got a company in the aegis, the orbit of his sort of endeavours, called Neuralink. And Neuralink take these neural implant chips and try to help people who've got things like disabilities. And you say, well, okay, what can you do? So another thing that came to mind is sort of back in 1961, IBM, those wonderful computer people, had an IBM sort of computer, which was, I think, the IBM 7094 computer. And it did something which was quite astounding at its time. They created this through a couple of their researchers. They got the computer to sing. And it was the first computer to sing, and it sang a very old tune from the late 1800s called Daisy. remember. Daisy, Daisy.
Give me your answer, do.
Yeah,
that one.
on the bicycle made for two. Well, they got the computer to play a bit of music into that and to sing the song. And if you think, bring that up to date and you phone up to somewhere and go, I would like to complain, you know, which department do you require? Well, I want to complain. Yes, well, can we help you? Can you tell us what it's about? And you're talking to a chatbot.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we've got those kind of things and they've moved forward. And I think that a lot of people with things like MND, motor neuron disease, start to lose control of functions. And way back in the past, I worked in education, and they were doing things like tracking eye movements. So they could shine a light into your eye while you were doing sort of different tasks. But then a computer could log the way your eyes moved. So they started to plot how when you see a new face, your eyes move around that face and to different areas. They could say, well, okay, when you first see somebody, you kind of look at their eyes. And then you also look down to the mouth to see if they're speaking. And then you also look back at their eyes and backwards and forwards. Then you'll start to take in peripheral stuff like the shape of the face, the colour of the hair, and other things. So that kind of work. Now you'll see the police forces in the UK are going to have facial recognition. And the seeds of that go back 40, 50 years, I guess. So you look at these things, and if you want to look at that technology, then you can see that something like Neuralink, they started out with a chip that has, I think they said, about 2,000 microfiber copper links that are implanted to communicate with your brain. And it learns things from your brain, but it also takes messages, the neural signals from your brain, and can try and activate things like computers or, say, an electric lift if you're disabled to lift you up to move you around. So they're trying to give people back that kind of a freedom. And the sort of cost side of that is having a surgical implant of a chip. And if you want to sort of go back about 40 years again, the start of things was some research here in the UK into RFID chips, which is radio frequency chips. The kind of things that when you've been and just purchased a new garment from up and you get to the door going out and an alarm goes off.
Well, you might, Paul. I'm not sure about everybody else.
Well, sometimes they forget to take the tag off
yes.
Or whatever. But obviously it is there as a security issue for the shop. But it's using that technology. So what you'll find is somewhere there's a printed coil in the tag, and that kind of is the thing that will trigger that system. But in research, again, what they found is that they could actually implant an RFID chip, and places in some of the tech companies, rather than you having keys and identities, you put all of that into an RFID chip, which could be injected under your skin.
So when
you appeared at the door, it recognised you through that device and would allow you to open the door, and it could be encoded to give you access to different parts and various other things. So that sort of technology, again brought forward in neural implants, could allow you to control things. So it's one of those things, and I say, if you think about the leap from Cybermen or the leap from controlling animal behaviour, I mean, that was kind of high-end in its time, because if you think about animal behaviour, we started to condition animals thousands of years ago, training dogs to be hunting companions, training cattle to move around and be domesticated. So there's a whole process that's gone on before where you've developed those kind of things. Now what they're doing is giving you a command override, if you like, with a neural implant that you can guide. So I say pigeons did fantastic things when they realised they got a homing instinct. First World War, they were sending messages back. And prior to the First World War, pigeons were used as message carriers. And famously, they won the animal VC for a tremendous feat of flying.
Yeah, it's unbelievable, isn't it? I think that was an Antiques Roadshow.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes. So I'd say it's a very interesting area, and I say Neuralink's doing this work, but we've also spoken recently about the implant into people's eyes who've got sight loss. And again, that's a chip that's mounted on the back of the retina, and it's used to pick up information. I think they use it in conjunction with what they call smart glasses that you wear, and that information is transmitted back in your smart glasses and converted to give you a definition and an outline, but also it's getting to the point where it gives you the ability to read. So this sort of augmentation, the cybernauts, the people who maybe are going to have that kind of an implant, will develop either communication skills or the next generation. And I was amazed to look at some recent sort of developments in exoskeletons, which is basically a suit that you can use to surround your body to enhance your ability to lift. But the surprising one that caught my eye was a lightweight exoskeleton that fits around your waist and down to your back of your knees. And they say that can actually help you to run further without fatigue. So it's a sports device now.
Good grief.
Wow.
Yeah, it's incredible. And this thing weighs under 2 kilograms. So you can sort of see, well, you know, what are the shortcomings of this poor old human frame that we've got, and what can we do to overcome it? So this sort of drift towards neural links is opening up lots of different avenues to either correct problems or to augment our sort of innate systems and develop them to become things far better. And I believe that part of what's happening now is with the artificial intelligence development, another part of Elon Musk's company is planning to put data centers into satellites in space, so that you can have a much wider neural network that artificial intelligence can communicate with. And I think the line was that then we can project the human sort of vision out beyond the limits of the planet.
It's interesting. I know you asked for, have we got a track by Doctor Who or the Doctor Who theme? I can see why you wanted it now, Paul, because way back when I was a kid watching that, all this sort of thing seemed just surreal, didn't it? They were just science fiction on the TV, and actually they're becoming more and more real.
Yes, I think that was really the thing that was surprising from that little sort of thing about the pigeon. Just sort of triggered a lot of memories from all sorts of places, and just sort of looking to the future, you can see there's hope. Again, artificial intelligence can be good or bad, as most of the things that mankind gets involved in can be.
Exactly. Brilliant. All interesting stuff, Paul, and we shall speak to you Monday. Glory Days Rock Show, 1 till 3. Yes.
Good old show.
Bye-bye, Paul. Bye.
Cheers.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
You and me, we were the pretenders. We let it all slip away. In the end, what you don't surrender, well, the world just strips away. Girl, ain't no kindness in the face of strangers. We ain't gonna find no miracles here. Well, you can wait on your blessings, my darling. I got a deal for you right here. I ain't looking for prayers of pity. I ain't coming around searching for a crush. I just want someone to talk to and a little of that human touch. Just a little of that human touch. On the streets of this town, ain't no bread from heavenly skies. Ain't nobody drawing wine from this blood. It's just you and me tonight. Tell me in a world without pity, do you think what I'm asking's too much? I just want something to hold.
Nice track there for RPG, Human Touch by Bruce Springsteen, because RPG was talking about all sorts of neural links and the way the world is going with artificial intelligence and implants and all sorts of crazy things. Amazing. You're listening to the Live Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM. We should have our Phil on the line. Good morning, Phil. Good morning. Oh, where is he? Oh, are you there, Phil? Mate. I've got you. I hadn't plugged you in properly.
Oh, I need to be plugged in.
I know. Without swearing, Phil, what sort of week have you had?
What kind of words can I do?
Yeah, you can have rubbish.
It's been rubbish.
Oh, well, last week we spoke to you, and I said, you sound like you've got a bit of a cold. And you went, I think I'm all right.
Yes, you're right. I've had a bad week.
You've had a bad week, but foolishly...
We've had a run this morning. No, I'm getting over it. I needed a run this morning.
Yeah, I'm going to say it. Foolishly, you had a run this morning just because the sun... You thought the sun was shining.
Well, we've got a Couch 5K group into week four, so I had to do that.
You had to, yeah.
I had to do that, so that was easy. That was really easy. And then it was a case of we'll go for a bit of a sprint down Manvers Way. So we had our own members were as well. So.
Brilliant.
Anyway, it helped clear my lungs out.
Did it? Did it? Brilliant. Well, now you've got your cup of coffee now. You're all settled, aren't you?
Yes.
Things are going to get better now, Phil, aren't they? Right, so last week we spoke to you, but this week we're going to speak to you about Iron Sky, Planets Constellations, club news, all sorts going off in your club. Where do you want to start?
Oh, crikey. Well, we had a cracking meeting on Thursday. We had a lady called Sue come from the Royal Astronomical Society, and she talked on Meet the Herschels, which was an absolute eye-opening talk. Nice to have somebody in the room for once. And basically, it was a German astronomer that came to England with the Georges, as in George the Second and Third, and moved down to Bath, and basically... He went from being a musician to being an amateur astronomer.
Wow.
And not only did he do amateur astronomy, as in look at the stars, he also started making his own equipment. And he became the best mirror grinder in the country to such an extent. He made the biggest mirrors in the world, which were the 18-inch that he built. And he also built a 24-inch when he finished. Although it weren't very practical to use, inch reflector, which was huge. And he discovered Uranus in 1881 and named it after King George, which took him to very high favour.
Yeah.
And he basically was the court astronomer for George III. So he ended up being reasonably wealthy, and he was the astronomer to go to. And he discovered about 2,500 objects in the sky. All them little fuzzy things that we want to look at and photograph, he discovered with an 18-inch telescope back in the 1870s and 1880s.
Wow.
He was an absolute phenomenal astronomer, and he kind of rewrote... Well, there had been star atlases before, but he took it to the next level.
To another level.
He actually worked out through his star observation catalogue that many new stars, and to a high degree of accuracy as well. He worked out the shape of the universe, and the universe at the time, we were the centre of it, and we didn't realise we lived in a galaxy, but he did a cross-section through the galaxy, and that was our universe. And it wasn't until the 1920s we actually realised that there was a universe outside of our own galaxy. And it's when we started looking at things like Andromeda and then realised it was like 2.25 million light years away, which was a separate galaxy all on its own. And then we suddenly realised in the 1920s that actually the universe was a much bigger place.
Wow. So this speaker, this Sue, you said she come from the Royal Astronomy Society.
Yeah, you remember the Royal Astronomy
Society. How come she came in person? Because obviously since COVID, you're generally doing it on...
We do try and get guest speakers in, but obviously we have to pay for them to travel. So I don't know how much we paid her, but obviously a lot of people, guest speakers, do give the time freely.
Yeah.
Usually it's like when we get people from Sheffield University, they have to provide so much kind of free time for tutorials and spreading the word of science. So they use like things like clubs to like
get... Yeah, it's their continual professional development, isn't it?
Yeah. And it's bringing on new people as well. I mean, our club wouldn't be where it is today if we hadn't had people come and talk to us. It's great reading books, but being in a club can take you to the next level. I mean, all stuff that's happening that hasn't been written yet
Yeah.
Because people are developing stuff, especially when you speak to lecturers. And you can get you through the door, and it's like, oh, questions and answers, and what you're doing at the moment, and you're finding out what people are doing and searching so at the moment.
Well, there's a lot of research, isn't there, going on all the time in all sorts of scientific fields, yeah. But astronomy, it just, yeah.
It keeps on going, and it's like the Gaia telescope has been and plotted all these star movements and where things are going now, things are moving around, and it's opened up another branch. And then it's not just our solar system. It's like there's so much out there that we don't know. And we're pushing the technology and the boundaries, as I'm finding with my telescope and my CCD cameras.
The continuing journey of your telescope. Going back to this Herschel man, this Herschel, yeah. is it William Herschel?
It actually was a Wilhelm.
Wilhelm.
But he became naturalised and changed it to William to fit in better. But it was like an amateur astronomer, and he just got famous because he discovered things, and he published, and people went round to his house. He was that famous with the upper class. People used to come and visit him. And he was, come and look through my telescope, because we're cutting edge,
even back then.
Come and have a look at these planets. You know, have a look at the moon, and it's when we were looking at the moon from the point of view that there was possibly life on the moon, and people were looking for it, and seasonal changes, are things changing on the moon? So alien life being out in the solar system isn't a new concept. It's been there for a long, long time.
Mm. So when you talked about him, he was one of the best mirror grinders. You meant he's grinding mirrors for his telescopes, isn't he?
Yeah.
He ain't doing it to look and...
As a musician, well, when he was in Germany... they were handy, so a lot of people had handicrafts, so he was really good at woodwork. It weren't just technical, like mathematics and music. They were also working with wood, they were working with metal. And in his house in Bath, it's now a museum, you can go and visit it.
Oh, that.
If you go to Bath, you'll visit Herschel's house. It's absolutely brilliant. That's where he made a lot of his mirrors. And if you go down his steps into his backyard, there's actually a workshop. It's like a kitchen at the back of the house. He actually had he made a wooden jig where you could like put a speculum plate on it and then start to grind. And nobody had a specific way of grinding a mirror. You just needed a curve in it. He actually developed the best way to put a curve in a piece of metal. We called it speculum. It was like a soft alloy. They were very shiny. And get the right curve so it'll focus at a specific point. And he's got his 8-inch reflecting telescope, which is in the back room of the observatory, all made out of oak, and he made it himself.
Wow.
Pulleys and levers, brass and iron. And they could turn their own equipment, little workshop, and make things absolutely unbelievable. So he didn't pay somebody to make something. Most astronomers that were like in the brewing industry had paid people to build them telescopes. He made his gear and used it, and he knew what he wanted, and he was the best person to do it. And he was the best telescope maker at the time.
Wow. You can still use his telescopes then?
I don't think it's for use. I think it's more of an exhibition.
But it probably would. Would it still work? Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
You see?
I mean, it's like telescopes last... I've got a refracting telescope from a lieutenant in the Navy from about 1820, and it still works. You couldn't see through it when I bought it for 20 quid from an antique shop. But what I did is I took it to pieces, looked up how to clean stuff, cleaned the brass using lemon and flour. And then the lenses are cleaned up as well, put it all back together, and it works absolutely fantastic.
Does it?
And the thing is, what you've got to imagine is, can you remember when they used to go out on ships and they'd be out for years? The equipment that you had to be able to repair it and use it.
Yeah, so, yeah, for sure.
So if you're in the Caribbean fighting the Spanish and the French, and... your telescope takes a knock, you've got to be able to put it back together again.
You can't imagine that now, can you, in the modern world?
No,
we live in.
No, you'd need somebody in IT to put me a request in, and I'll get back to you in a couple of days.
Brilliant.
It's a different world.
Some it is.
A lot more practical.
I remember because we're sailors. I mean, we haven't sailed for quite a long time. But when we did all our navigation and stuff, we often talked about at some point doing astral navigation.
Yeah.
Really difficult. You rely on the sky, the horizon, you know. And if it's cloudy, then what do you do?
Yeah. Well, that's how Sir Cloudless Shovel ended up destroying a fleet of ships in the English Channel. He ran a fleet onto the Scilly Isles. I think they lost about 20 ships and a couple of thousand men. And that is what triggered the longitude quest with Masculine and Captain Cook and Charles Green from Wentworth and Swinton.
Swinton!
Talking about next week.
I know, well, don't spoil it, Phil. Don't talk about it, but I do know that on the 12th of February, which is not far away, you're going to be talking at Wentworth Women's Institute. Oh, my God.
I've got a special request to go and talk to them.
I know. You're going to go down a storm, aren't you? You just know you are, don't you?
Yeah. And the guy came from Swinton. He was born in 1734. His dad was a farmer, gentleman farmer, who started off Rockingham Pottery down at Swinton Meadows, down at Rome's Lane in Swinton.
You can't.
And then, and then moved to Wentworth before he was born. And of course, he grew up with the Wentworths, was educated, and ended up going to London and ended up in the Royal Observatory and went on the ship.
Don't tell us anymore.
Yeah, I best not tell you anymore.
People need to book onto the Wentworth Women's Institute talk 12th of February. Phil Muffet covering Charles Green of Swinton. Yeah. Amazing. Yeah. But at some point, you're going to come and talk about that, aren't you? Because you're going to do your talk there, but you're going to have to come and tell the story because it's so, I mean, you are in your sort of real world job. You are, an officer that deals with that Wentworth area, so you've got a lot of knowledge about Wentworth, haven't you?
I've worked on the house and the stable block and a few in the house. It's all fantastic. Georgian period was really, we're part of the Industrial Revolution, especially in the Wentworth area. And I'm building cannons, Walker family, iron foundry in Masborough, revolutionised gun technology, help fuel the expansion of the empire in the 18th century. Standardisation of guns, powder, it changed the world.
Yeah, you can, and that's just in that local area.
Oh, yeah, it's amazing. When you start digging about things that the Wentworth family and the spin-offs from it, it's huge. It's global.
They were wealthy, very wealthy, weren't they?
You could almost say the Wentworths were the Jeff Bezos of today.
Yeah.
With the amount of money and the influence they had was absolutely massive. And the thing, they were developing in technology. Technology was being advanced in sciences. Mining technology, ironwork, everything, astronomy.
Because there's the Newcomen beam engine, isn't there, at Elsica? Because Elsica station, Elsica, that was a part of the Wentworth estate, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was, yeah.
Yeah, brilliant. But don't give any more away, Phil. Don't give any more away.
Okay, yeah.
And at some point in the future, obviously, I wouldn't say at the top of the show, you are for a member of Mexburn Swinton Astronomical Society.
For my sins,
For your sins, will you? The question is, will you be the next president?
No, don't think so. We need somebody famous.
Yeah, but who's it going to be?
I don't know.
We think Brian Cox, Professor Brian Cox. Why won't he come?
We want somebody that can actually come and visit us once in a while.
He might do. But there's a reason for that, though, isn't there? And you're not going to talk much about it now, but we'll probably cover it in a future show. But your president, Dr. Alan Chapman, you said he sadly passed away, and you said what a loss to humanity.
Yes, absolutely amazing person, and he actually comes from Swinton.
Does he? No way.
In Lancashire.
Oh.
We had quite a bit of rivalry between which was the best swing, the Lancashire Swinton or the Yorkshire Swinton.
Yorkshire. There's no doubt about that. But the sadly, he's passed away. So he was your president, yes. But for how long then?
We had him from the mid-1990s.
Wow.
Yeah.
So it's it's big shoes to step into then, whoever takes it.
Yes. It is. It was a doctor of history at Oxford University. And he actually gave us several guided tours around Oxford University. Radcliffe Observatory and St John's College, Oxford, History of Science Museum, wow. Trinity College, Bodleian Library. He's took us around all them buildings, and I must, in the summer, and we've done it a couple of times, and he's like guided tour with a doctor. Absolutely mind-blowing.
Phenomenal, yeah.
I don't know if you ever watch Morse, but when Morse goes around those buildings in Oxford and you actually recognise the buildings, it puts a completely different dimension on watching TV.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Because you actually think, they must film the entire series of Morse within a square mile in York, because all the buildings are right there in the middle.
Yeah.
And it's amazing. It's an amazing place. Dangerous place to live, obviously, because obviously somebody dies every week.
Do they?
Well, they do on TV, don't they?
Oh, I see what you mean. I think about Oxford, I'm like, what?
There's a murder every week in Oxford, isn't there?
Like Midsummer Murders.
Midsummer Murders, and we haven't watched that for years. But anyway, going on to some of your events coming up. Well, as always, you do these public viewing events. You put them up for sale. They're not expensive things to book onto, but they just get sold out, don't they?
Yeah, they do, yes. We've got another sell out for the 27th.
So
even if it's cloudy, we still do a PV.
Yeah, and this is...
A planetarium show as well.
This is up at your Hubert Observatory. So that's sold out, and that was the 20th. Is that the 27th, did you say?
27th. Yeah, and on the 28th, on the Saturday, we're doing Planets in the Park, which anybody can come to, and it's in the garden part of the museum around the back. They've got like an auditorium. It's like a meeting area and a square that's sheltered. So we turn up some telescopes, show people the sky, and we also have a couple of talks as well.
So that's Clifton Park in Rotherham, isn't it?
Yes.
Because you've done things with them. I think last year, did it get cancelled because the weather was so bad?
Yes.
Boo.
To be honest, I still think we could have done something. We could have done a display, talk about telescopes, and I could have still done a planetarium show. But the guys decided that it weren't worth it.
No, well, let's hope it's better weather this year. So it's 28th of Feb, Planets in the Park. And what time does it start?
About 7 o'clock.
So you can...
About.
When it's gone dark, you mean?
People just... Yeah, when it's gone dark.
And to be fair, though, they've been very popular events. Are they free? Is that one free? You just turn up?
Yeah, people just turn up. And it's what... And people sometimes bring telescopes. How do I put this together? And I can't see through it, and which end do I look through? All that kind of stuff.
But you know, you have had a lot of people turn up to those events, of all ages, to be fair.
Yeah. But one of the good things about Plants in the Park, parents do tend to bring the children, which is
great, isn't it? Get them off the screens.
We can't get young people in the society, but yet plenty of young people do turn up at events.
Isn't it interesting? So you mean as in your club?
Yes, because we're an ageing society. As most clubs and societies are, they're an older generation rather than the younger generation, and really you need that younger generation coming in, learning stuff, and repopulating societies that are disappearing.
Yeah, it's same with the Sheffield Photographic Society. They have got some new members just because they have exhibitions of photography and people then get interested in it. Yeah. But generally, it is the people have been doing it. It's one of them you know, your hobby, isn't it?
I've got one myself, my son. Everything's online.
Ooh!
Do you fancy coming out? Oh, no, it's all right, Dad, I'm doing something else. Everything's online.
Yeah.
And that's great. It's great. It's like us doing a Zoom meeting on a Thursday. doing it online is great. You can get people that you've never seen before and can't travel to wherever you are, which is great. But like Thursday, we had a guest speaker come to the club, and there's nothing like
going
out there, meeting somebody. You can't do everything online.
No, it's that face-to-face, and you're learning from some of the, you know...
And it's that social interaction as well.
It is.
I mean, you meet people, and you can talk openly and freely. Everybody's nice. And it's, you can talk to people, and, what have you been doing about this, and what have you been doing with this, and how do you do this? You only get that from a club, and it's like knowing somebody like that, Dr. Alan Chapman. He got us into... I'd have never, ever... going into Oxford University, if I hadn't known Alan Chapman, and if I hadn't been in a club.
Exactly.
Having a club trip around Oxford University absolutely blew our minds. Absolutely.
Did it beat Jodrell Bank? Oh, difficult.
That's really difficult.
It is.
It's another 10 out of 10, but for a different reason.
For a different reason. And on that note, Phil, I'm afraid we're going to have to let you go, sadly.
Thank you very much.
Okay, we'll speak to you.
Thank you.
You can see stuff in the sky this morning.
Let's hope we can. Yeah. Brilliant.
Bye-bye.
All right, Phil. Thank you very much. Bye-bye. Take care. Bye.
Killing me.